Rich heretics push narcotics amidst its risks and frisks. Cool clicks throw bricks, but seldom get targets. Private dicks sell hits like porno flicks.
And good morning. That was the Fugees to lead us off this morning with Wednesday Talk Radio. As every third Wednesday, I have with me Sarah and Jonathan from Portland Assembly. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you, Paul?
I'm pretty well. Yourselves?
Good.
All right, we're going to be talking about gay shame and what's going on in the Bay Area. And here are some commonalities, some differences regarding hyper-gentrification and a lot of other issues. And we're going to have a couple guests from the group Gay Shame of San Francisco, Ralau Ampu and Toshio Maronek. I guess I could ask you how to pronounce their names before I try to read them on the air. And they'll be calling in a few minutes. But first, we're going to be talking about, just give our take on the events of this weekend. I'm sure everybody knows what I'm referring to. It's been all over the news. It didn't turn out to be the way that some of our local and certainly some national press, certainly on the right, made it out to be what might happen on Saturday. Of course, here's the Portland Tribune. Downtown protest, disaster averted.
That's a funny one, considering that, you know, disaster averted because the police decided not to create a disaster, I guess.
Well, to spell that out a little more, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, the police approach, the PPB approach to protests seems to be about control and about keeping groups separated. So it was pretty successful, I guess, as far as that goes. But also, I think that, well, it was also successful as an information gathering mission, clearly, for the police.
Like 13 or 14 different agencies involved, apparently.
Yeah, there were far more police than there were anything else down there.
A fusion exercise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it didn't change their obvious, you know, fondness for white nationalists. They opened an entirely closed bridge that we're not allowed to use to march them across it. They pretty much led them on a prolonged march around the city for which they were not permitted. So
I heard they got a free parade.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
basically. So, I mean, disaster averted for whom? I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I heard Joanne Hardesty of KBOO's, both a longtime KBOO talk show host on Thursdays, I'm sure everybody who listens knows, and also a city commissioner, and she was on Democracy Now! Yesterday, or Monday, and she did an amazingly good job in her position, and very well spoken, but the narrative, it was her narrative, which I think is a very positive and good narrative and correct, that in a lot of ways the city kind of stood up against white supremacy. But part of the official narrative that kind of maybe she kind of has to do is that, you know, the city did such a great job, you know, and as you're saying, it's like the good job is because, you know, as you're saying, that the police didn't beat up on protesters is basically, but you know, you got to give them some credit, I guess, that they did sort of keep people separated. There wasn't this huge.
Give Joanne a lot of credit, because I think that she's one of the only city officials who has unequivocally stated what's going on. And I think, like, one of the reasons that I don't consider this a resounding success or whatever is because this has been going on for 2 years, almost three. It's ridiculous, and if I gotta say, if Wheeler had treated it, say, like the mayor of Boston, who showed up on the streets with the people of his city,
40,000 deep too, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
That is a unified front against fascism, and I find his equivocation to be real weak and disappointing. So I'm glad that there's someone like Joanne who is willing to call white supremacy out in as many words, because it's vital. So I really appreciate that. But it also, I mean, how much money are we pouring into this? Like, and you know.
Enough so that you got to go make sure all the headlines after the fact make you look good.
Yeah, exactly.
That's basically the way it seems to me.
Exactly.
There was no problem for them to solve. They didn't create one themselves. They're going to give themselves a big pat on the back. Mission accomplished. You know, the Gulf War never took place. That's kind of what it seems like, right? This is their celebratory sensationalist campaign, and it's going to look just like this every time because they get good PR out of it.
Well, and it... I also think that it points us at a systemic problem as far as how we address issues in the city. We just pour more money into police response, right? Whereas there are so many things that we could do in a preventative manner to make this not happen. It's the same thing, honestly, let's just segue right into talking about sweeps, because we have so many options. And yet we're just pouring more and more money into police response. So we, you know, KBOO is in the district that we talk about, but the Central East Side Industrial Council, if you'll remember, we had talked about that fairly extensively, a few months ago. And the city made an agreement with the Central East Side Industrial Council, which is a business district. It's a business improvement district.
27 members of developers too, right? Mostly developers.
It's 36 members of 100 and something member council are developers. So yeah. It is a developer pushed coalition to take advantage of Trump's opportunity zoning. Basically, so just to recap, one of the things they do, though, is they have access to public funding through parking meter revenue. So they are spending some of their money, but also some of ours, and it's also subsidized by the city. When we went into deliberation with the city council and the industrial Central East Side Industrial Council, one of the things that was discussed was not using police in sweeps in the area, stepping down the amount of sweeps in the area. These were all agreements that were come to.
Let's just, sweeps has become sort of this word that's used, and it's means basically like evicting people who've got no other place to go, who are camping out or being or living in some place out in public.
Yeah, that is exactly what it is. And so if somebody is camping in a park or on a street, they will be posted, which means that some public entity will come around and post a notice that says that their camp must be gone within 48 hours or it's subject to removal. It's been very interesting to observe in the Central East Side because those notices are being served by Portland Patrol Services, which is the private security team hired by the Central East Side to not utilize police, right? That was the whole promise that they made, was that they weren't going to use cops and they were going to use these private cops instead.
I get what they meant by low-barrier uniforms. They're just going to wait and then surprise you with the ticket and the eviction and the rest.
Oh, exactly. So, but these things that Portland Patrol Services, a private security company, is posting notices that seem to give them a smaller window of time so that they can sweep sooner than the actual city or PBOT,
Bureau of Transportation.
Bureau of Transportation can. Yeah. And those notices actually have an official city stamp on them, which confused me a little bit. So
kind of a strange blending of the
Public-private partnership.
Yeah. So then a friend of mine...
Isn't that the definition of fascism? Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
it's we have to define that
we
so much these days.
We call it neoliberalism now, thank you.
But, so I got a call from a friend who had been served notice, and we went down to support him and help him move his stuff. And when we got there, there was Portland Patrol, and whatever their sister company is, which is like Positive Action, I believe they're called, and it's their cleanup company. But the workers wear shirts that say both things. And then there were also Multnomah County inmate crew doing the cleanup, Portland police there, and Multnomah County sheriffs there. So they have managed to use our money to hire private police, but are also using city funding to have police staff on site, despite the fact that they said that their goal was otherwise. So, and this has been, they've been sweeping weekly. So this is ramping up, and it's something that we feel like we really are needing to address.
Well, just because it really bothers me, especially, this was all the behest of that council, of this business council, right? So this wasn't necessarily something that the city thought up on their own, but it was these businesses who thought it up and got it implemented, which to me is almost worse, because then the cities are kind of waiting around doing nothing until the business entities are like, we like this, and then they go with it immediately,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that money had no democratic process around it. It was just allocated to this business improvement district based off precedent or whatever. And it's just the exact same thing that almost the police were trying to pull with their whole rebadging of sweeps and like how they're going to handle it nicer. And, you know, it's,
well, and actually this is a great lean in to our guests, mm-hmm. because one of the, I'm pretty excited. We have Gay Shame coming on today. They are a group out of the Bay Area. And when I was living in the Bay Area in the late 90s, they started some anti-sweeps campaigns down there. And that was always a big problem in San Francisco, because unhoused folks would be swept, would move two blocks down, would be swept. It was a vicious circle.
And this is iconic Gay Shame, leave my body on the steps of the Capitol organizing.
From that movement, yes. Mm-hmm. And then they definitely have spearheaded like Cops Out of Pride, mm-hmm. down there. They focus on... capitalist incursion into queer spaces, so places that should be anti-establishment and anti-capitalist, they try to make sure that those borders are less fluid for money.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually pretty excited to have them on. I've had a bit of an organizer crush on them for a while. I love how just fierce and uncompromising and petty they are in their attacks against YIMBYs and the city.
I love being petty against the city.
Well,
what are YIMBYs?
Oh, YIMBYs. YIMBYs are yes in my backyard-ers, I suppose. So these are people who are pro-construction, pro-development. And it's posed as the alternate to the NIMBY narrative, which is not in my backyard. And those are people who do not want building and who may have racial or class reasons for doing so. So the YIMBYs try to pose themselves as the opposite of that, which they're not. They are neoliberal developers, basically, who are pushing new urbanism.
You can't be anti-racist if you're a capitalist, right?
That's yes, it's
it.
Very true.
Yeah.
So I am super excited. Today we've got Toshio Marinek and Roloe Ampu from Gay Shame in San Francisco. Hey, Toshio, are you there?
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, welcome. Thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you for inviting us.
Are you on speakerphone by any chance?
We are, we'll get right off that.
Because the speakerphone doesn't actually work so well on the air. I don't know if there's a way to work around that, possibly.
Work around that, possibly?
Sorry for the technical.
Can you still hear us?
That's yeah. Much better. Much better. Yes, thank you.
Okay, cool.
All right.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good. How are you guys?
We're doing good, you know.
Right on. Well, thanks very much for coming on. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your work with Gay Shame and like why Gay Shame has been going so delightfully hard against YIMBYs and gentrification in San Francisco and specifically the Tenderloin?
Yeah, Gay Shame is a radical queer direct action group, and we've been really in existence since 2001, originally to combat sort of the assimilation and hyper-capitalism of gay pride. And over the years, we've had because of our class politics, fallen into these fights against gentrification and these sort of classist fights against City Hall and like anti-poor legislation. And that sort of has made us a lot of enemies, and we've sort of been in a lot of losing battles with city bureaucrats and other politicians, and this is just kind of the present manifestation of that sort of ongoing struggle.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of got involved with YIMBYs because, of course, gentrification and how they emerged on the scene, characterizing themselves as being the pro-development wing of the anti-displacement movement, which actually makes no sense. they're kind of like one of the astroturfing sort of movement par excellence. Like, it's nothing really to compare it to.
Mm-hmm.
There really hasn't been a time when you've had basically conservative business interests trying to pass themselves off as like a popular movement.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just very like striking and weird, and they haven't. It's clear that real estate interests are sort of delving into something that they've never done before. Because if you see a lot of their conferences and things that they have, like they held a conference in downtown Oakland, the YIMBY Town. I don't know what number it was. If it was the first or second, but almost everyone in attendance was white, and so they always.
Oh no. That's not good.
We dropped them. If y'all can call back in, Rolo and Toshio, we'll wait for you. That's actually a pretty good place to start, because one of the things that we've noticed is that it is pretty difficult to win these fights with the city. And it's equally as difficult when we are, trying to work in cooperation with them. So because these city forces, these city officials are so closely tied to developers and so enmeshed in sort of this like building and gentrification like cycle, they are always going to have goals that motivate them to do the opposite of what we want them to do.
I think we've even talked about it before a little bit at length, just how it's more over the history of capitalist dynamics in the city that will just kind of allow these actors to continue that way, whether or not it's their real motivations or like they personally know the whole history and believe it wholeheartedly. It's just simply the fact that all the way back since the tax bracket was imposed in cities to kind of, property taxes themselves, there was this game to incur more development from Europe by decreasing the friction for capitalist interests to come develop the city core center ever since the early development of the colonies, right? So like even now we're seeing like Up for Growth is just a new flavor of that, right? It's mm-hmm, these cities mm-hmm. that are established now, these pioneers who are trying to get bigger investment from Europe, from the mainland.
Yeah. Did we get them back yet?
Ooh, maybe.
Apparently not.
Oh,
we better get Liam their number, but I guess they know ours. Anyway, while we're waiting, we're going to keep talking about what we've been talking about, which is, as Jonathan and Sarah said, various strategies that cities utilize to get their tax base, obviously, because the politicians wouldn't have jobs if it wasn't for the money coming in.
Well, it's an interesting thing to sort of track, especially in Oregon. There has been so much fighting against property taxes, right? I remember even like when I was a kid, there was a lot of fighting about paying property taxes. Measure 5 went through and cut or put a freeze on property tax increases, which hit schools incredibly hard. Just real quick, the number to call in is 503-231-8187. We're kind of keeping the phone open for Gay Shame to call back in, but we'll be taking callers in about 10-15 minutes as well. So that number again, 503-231-8187 to get to the KABU line.
No, I've just asked you to write down their number so Liam can call them back.
They were going to Skype, so I don't have their numbers.
Oh, okay. Sorry to air our internal issues over the air here, but I just wanted to get clear about that. So basically, we're waiting for them to call us back.
We sent them an email. Hopefully it'll work.
Yeah. So I actually lived in San Francisco for a while, and I'm going to lay a little groundwork for one of the questions that I wanted to ask them. Which was about there's a new development, the Transgender Cultural District, and it's my old neighborhood, which so I definitely like have some feelings about this. Actually, it sounds like they're back.
I would love for them to chime in on that.
Hey, Rollo and Toshio, do you guys want to can we talk a little bit about the Transgender Cultural District?
Love to.
Welcome back, by the way. Thank you.
To you from the Transcultural District at the moment. And it's a problem. It feels like it's neoliberalism in its grossest form in a lot of ways. I previously worked for a nonprofit that helped to usher in this concept of the Transcultural District, which is really, it's a way for developers to get backing from communities that are fighting over scraps, basically. Mm. Here in San Francisco, they designated part of the Tenderloin and part of SoMa that has historically been home to a lot of trans and queer people as the Transcultural District. And it was this basically a PR campaign by a local developer that wants to build something like 300 market rate units that will be unaffordable to just about absolutely all of those trans and queer people that I just mentioned, right in the center of the district. And for the low price of $300,000, which would not buy you even one of these units, they were able to turn a few of the local groups to back them, so they look good in front of City Hall. They can show that they have this community support. That $300,000 went to the salary of somebody who is supposedly the steward of this district, somebody who doesn't actually live in the district, also to public arts, which brings up this idea of art washing that we've been talking about down here, which it was
the first person that they approached to do a mural about transgender history in the transgender cultural district actually lives in Athens, Greece. Doesn't even live in San Francisco. And so the idea is, okay, well, we'll have a mural of trans history that used to exist at one point in the Tenderloin in San Francisco, and that's it. Because these condos that they're building are so unaffordable, you'll have people, the new neighbors, calling 311 on people that lived in the neighborhood for years and years, who are trans and queer, and you know, the only people that are benefiting from this are a select few people that have bought into this kind of this idea that these developers have their best interests in mind, have been hired to, you know, help with creating these murals or what have you, and the developers themselves, of course, are benefiting greatly.
Yeah. So let's talk about one of the things that I notice down there is that you guys kind of have a unified group, like the way that techies. So one of the things that happened in San Francisco over the last 20 years is that a huge number of young straight cis white guys moved into the Bay Area to work for various tech companies, and they have real good salaries, and they have been driving a lot of the gentrification down there. So it feels in Portland like it's maybe like we don't have that unified sort of enemy the way that that techies have set themselves up in the YIMBY movement, and I find that kind of interesting.
I absolutely agree. And just real quick, as I want to add it in, there's also kind of evidence to show economically that those companies themselves are what are enabling all of the loans to build this new stuff to happen. So there's kind of circular feedback between big tech and big development. I'm sure you see that in the Bay. I'd be curious if you could go into a little bit of that, where these alliances tend to, like you said, these artists were hired, but who, right? Who hires these people?
Yeah, I find the alliances are a lot more clear down there.
Yeah,
it's more difficult to like draw the dot to dot for people in Portland, because I think that people are just more willing to believe how people represent themselves. So when we have people who are clearly like paid shills for Up for Growth saying this stuff, it is more difficult for us to get people to recognize that is rhetoric created by a think tank, you know?
You know, Clyde Holland sounds like a nice guy. I mean, you know, he's a billionaire, but whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We had one person who started a group called Mission YIMBY.
Ooh,
and now is running for local office, so he obviously had political aspirations.
Mm-hmm.
He works for Google, and I guess at Google you get one of the perks is you get a sabbatical or something like that. So he was paid by Google to work for one of the local campaigns for somebody who was just running on a YIMBY platform, basically.
Damn.
One of the districts in central San Francisco, the largest district in San Francisco with the most people in it. And she ended up losing in the end, but it was so clear, like, how do you have these people that are basically able to work 9 to 5 and beyond for the YIMBY cause, it's because they have these cush jobs, and then in addition we have like the statewide group California YIMBY was funded in large part by people from Microsoft and companies like Stripe, which is a payment processor that's based out of the Bay that most people have probably don't know that they've had to use before.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big pushes initially was to front as this progressive group. I think that they have more recently seen that that's not working so well for them, at least in the Bay, where YIMBYism amongst people who are paying attention to local politics, there's been a few instances where they've just kind of made fools of themselves, and so people are kind of becoming knowledgeable about the fact that YIMBYism, it's not like a social movement that is a grassroots movement. It's actually something that's very hyper professionalized. It was hatched in a PR lab, basically.
You mentioned astroturfing. Is that what astroturfing would define?
Yeah.
It's like a fake grassroots movement. It's like, it could be, you know, paid activists or like the shills that you're talking about.
Yeah.
So we have, you guys know Up for Growth, right?
Sonja Trauss.
I heard a little bit about them.
So Sonja Trauss just got, I know you love Sonja, got a big present, which is that she got an appointment to the Up for Growth Coalition Board. Up for Growth is a nationwide coalition. Our resident billionaire, Clyde Holland, who is in the pocket of Blackstone, the major company that owns half of the properties in the United States.
They're a Wall Street private equity company. For anybody who's just hearing this, it's a completely different ballgame, but now they're your biggest landlord as well. That's part of this whole issue.
So Clyde and Sonja are buddies, and they both work for this Up for Growth Coalition, which is funded by Blackstone and a lot of other like large corporations, many of whom are shrouded in secrecy.
Right.
Private equity itself is just to make money for rich people. That's what it means.
Yeah. So we are continually frustrated by, you know, trying to combat these paid shills while we work our day jobs, you know? But another thing, so I kind of wanted to ask, what tactics have you found that have been successful against that? And then, like, what rhetoric from the YIMBY side has been the most difficult to, like, debunk?
Well, in San Francisco, as we were talking earlier, tech has been one of the main engines behind all this havoc. And I think it's important to sort of start with like one of the key YIMBY myths, is that there already is enough housing. Like there's enough housing here if all the techies leave, you know? And who are techies? Techies are just rich people. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just like basically people who can afford to quote unquote fail, which is actually encouraged in their industry to sort of, you know, do things that aren't necessarily going to be profitable in the interest of whatever. It's like one of the reasons why I think that some YIMBYs, I mean, some techies really support this whole universal basic income idea. To sort of create more space for, like, you know, the people to just sort of, like, continue, you know, making money, like getting the government to sort of support them making money for corporations, basically, is like another form of neoliberalism. So like I think it's important for groups in other cities who are fighting against YIMBYs to all sort of work together and realize that there's a common cause. I think that any kind of anti-displacement, anti-gentrification work that's happening in one place, they need to, like, you know, work and, you know, and, like, support and, like, show up for things in other places. And, you know, I mean, I think between all of us, you know, say like in San Francisco, Portland, and then we got folks down like in LA.
LA, yeah.
Just sort of like figuring out how to sort of work together, because it's going to be a problem that we're increasingly going to have to face.
Well, and that seems to be one of the only like, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that actually seems one of the only practical ways to like fight these big like money-backed think tanks is that we sort of form our own, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, you had asked earlier about what has been a little bit more difficult to debunk. And I think this idea, Rollo just kind of hinted at it, but this idea that building more is just better in and of itself, like that's going to solve the problem of displacement and housing inequality and unaffordability. If we build more, this idea that, you know, this espousing of this trickle down economics that was popularized under Reagan has been something that they've pushed since the very beginning, that eventually if you build enough houses, some of those houses are going to become affordable to the rest of us. And I think that the simplicity of that argument, for some reason, I don't know, people forgot that trickle-down actually doesn't work, that if we give, you know, rich people what they want, they're not always going to pass that down to the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
So that, yeah, that's been a little bit harder to convey, to remind people of, that just building more, you know, more is not more in this instance.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to break in real quick. This is Paul Rowland, host of Wednesday Talk Radio. This is the third Wednesday Talk Radio where we have Sarah and Jonathan from Portland Assembly here in Portland, obviously. And we talk about these kind of issues, anti-capitalist issues of the complete takeover of our cities by development. Of course, they've always been taken over by development forces. This is just the latest iterations. And today we have from San Francisco, Raloe Ampu and Toshio Marinek from Gay Shame from San Francisco. And I just want to ask y'all really quick. So the term gay shame, I'm not sure we've really explained that. People might be curious what that means. And then if you could possibly follow up, and I'm really interested in the direct action component. Maybe you could speak a little bit about that.
Yeah, gay shame, as I sort of said, I think before we got cut off earlier, emerged originally, it started in New York, and then it sort of migrated out to San Francisco, and it began as a critique of assimilationist corporate pride. Sort of gay pride, especially in San Francisco, is like a huge money printing machine for San Francisco. Like I think during this last one, about 1 million people came into town. So it's a huge tourist thing. And you have every kind of corporation there. There were also protests, incidentally, this pride against the police presence, sort of in honor of the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. And, you know, which began as a riot against the police. And so basically, gay shame's critique of gay pride is that it's about how much it's completely, you know, changed course and embraced like the worst aspects of society rather than actually creating a place where people who are, you know, dealing with homophobia or just, you know, dealing with classism and racism can actually feel like they have a place. And so it began as an alternative to that, and sort of since I said like you know, we started in 2001, has sort of evolved into like an ongoing direct action project targeting the Yimbys. As I said, when they had their Oakland Yimby Town, I think that that was maybe 2 or 3 years ago. We did a protest there. It's just, it's really important to sort of, whenever you get an opportunity to really sort of challenge them, you know, directly face to face and in public, and also sort of like, you know, because it is something that people don't often feel like they have like a lot of, it's sort of, it's kind of like a thing that's invisible but not invisible. It's like, you know, you see the development happening everywhere and you see like it all going up, but you don't really know who to target or how to fight it. And so like we've used direct action to do that. We sort of get the word out on posters, we pasting and stuff. So like, yeah, like we did one of Sonia Trost early on, sort of when she was appearing on the scene, targeting her. And targeting, we have a couple targeting Sonya Trost, and we did some targeting Laura Foot Clark, who is also part of Yimby Action, or Yimby, I don't know, some sort of whatever the Yimby.
Yimby Action.
Yeah, Yimby Action. So yeah, also like Scott Wiener is also a huge Yimby, and
he's a local legislator who happens to be gay, and has used, I guess, his, you know, his being gay to political ends, and has become kind of the big Yimby in California politics, always pushing this quote unquote progressive a solution to the housing crisis, which in the end is really just benefiting developers and the politicians who benefit from the money of developers.
Let me just break in one more time real quick. If anybody wants to call in and get a question in to our guests from Gay Shame in San Francisco, you only have about 10-12 minutes left to do that. 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Let me turn it back over to Jonathan and Sarah.
Just because that really struck a chord with me, because our friend who we've had on the show before and have talked at length about this with has actually found some more candid internal messaging from these types of entities, where they actually, the developer coalition that first kind of broke into the Portland market, really pat themselves on the back for defeating the demolition tax, the flat tax that was a response to all of the initial demolitions here in Portland. And they basically said outright, like, oh, we use their progressive politics against them. You know, we just coded this in the language of racial politics, and they bought it hook, line, and sinker. And see, it's just continued. And, like, they'll admit it there, but now this PR campaign's out in the wild. So sounds like you're dealing with a similar problem.
Oh, yeah. They one of the things that Yimby locally did was form a group called Yimby Socialists.
Oh, gosh. Jesus.
And then it was founded by somebody who self-identifies as an anarchist, and it was just a huge mess, because there's no way that, you know, asking her about what caused her to start this, which was kind of just you know, a way to get progressive San Franciscans more interested in the idea of promoting more new market rate development. It was a way for them to do this that, you know, it just doesn't mesh with either socialism or anarchism because of who it's benefiting.
Yeah, well, what's in a name, right? Just because we've said it a few times, market rate, right? This whole fascination with market rate. There's an expectation, I think, from the people who buy into this, that the market can and will deliver those things as far as like affordable housing. But we know from discussion here that it's simply uncapped right now, and is tied to these fictitious money markets that are also driving this problem of the rents increasing forever and ever. I wonder if that key part is something people don't necessarily know, and I'm curious if y'all have done any organizing around that, but the involvement of these different Wall Street entities and these PR campaigns, and like we said, Blackstone directly tied to Up for Growth, they have an interest in creating more derivatives from all of these things, from the loans that are issued to the city, from the bonds that are created, municipal bonds.
From the new companies that they're starting to amortize rent so that they can give you basically a mortgage to pay your rent.
Yeah. What was that, Cadre from Goldman Sachs? Yeah. It's basically like an e-buyer,
iBuyer. Jared Kushner started a new company.
Right. So there's like an integration there that I think is coded in this kind of PR techie politic. Is there anything that you've noticed down there?
Yeah. In particular down here, something that's become really popular are these tech dorms.
Oh my God.
Formerly SROs, right?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. So they're converted from low-income housing and...
Well, and it's the last, stock of very low-income housing, right? So these SROs, which is a single-occupancy hotel, basically. So, we, in Portland, we had the Joyce Hotel. We had a number of hotels where people could get cheap rooms by the day, by the week, and it kept a lot of people from houselessness. And so those are now the ones that are being converted.
So who are these tech dorms for?
They're for techies, and they're overpriced bunk beds and stuff. I actually live in an SRO, and this issue is particularly intense for me because the nonprofit that owns and operates my home is actually run by YIMBY, which is not a shock, but I'm always concerned with them trying to flip the hotel and make it, just all techies, or just evict everyone, or buy up other properties in the neighborhood and do the same thing. So
well, you can only assume that they're just sitting on it waiting to do that, right?
So, yeah, I mean, it feels like that, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a whole different conversation, but the RAD program, the rental assistance scheme that Ben Carson and HUD are trying to push is effectively, they're trying to privatize all of the public housing. And so this is particularly concerning because this is happening so fast. There's so many SROs, whole buildings where they're getting people out under the guise of we're doing renovations, and then all of a sudden all the people that lived there before, during this time when the buildings were being renovated, they had to leave and find some other place to stay. And very few of them, we do have right of return here in San Francisco for people who are in buildings with, multiple units. I think it's about six. And a lot of those people are already gone by the time that the places reopen. And then, are they going to feel welcome in a place that is catering towards this group of new to San Francisco techies who are able to throw down a couple thousand dollars for a bunk bed?
So we've got a couple callers. Let's get a couple questions real quick. Joseph, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I'm a member since 2002. I really appreciate this, mostly because I turned on the radio in the middle of this, and I've never heard of this. So I just wanted to ask if you would just sort of maybe give a synopsis at the end. My biggest interest is in finding out what organization or group is monitoring these people so that I can stay abreast of this. I live in Vancouver, Washington, work in Portland, Oregon. I'd make a couple of comments, and that is this goes to houselessness, of course, but I read an article about a country, Sweden, I wanted to say, the way they solve it is to just buy a place for somebody. I just think we need to go back to public housing because privatizing, of course, we know is directed toward profit. I'll take your comments off the air.
Thank you, Jesse.
Thank you. That's actually, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you all about before we got offline was how do we make the conversation about free housing more serious? Like we're seeing in Berlin where moves are actually being made by like government officials to reclaim empty units for the people. Like
from these same multinationals, exact same companies, just saying.
Same companies, yeah. So I that's a great question, Joseph.
I do believe it.
We were just talking about the idea that in 1982, which actually, you know, it's a while back, the year I was born, but Acorn, which has, you know, been split into a million pieces, but at that point in time, they were actually doing some really amazing work around squatters' rights. And taking over these buildings that were completely empty. And like Rallo said at the beginning of the show, there are more empty condos. People call them ghost condos because they're often owned by investors or people who don't live in the city for most of the year. Places like they've done studies like in Canada and Toronto and Vancouver, looking at the numbers of condos that don't turn on their electricity over the course of 365 days. And in all of these cases, they've shown that the number of these ghost condos are far and away above the number of houseless people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the numbers in Portland are something like 6 empty units for each unhoused person.
18,000 last count.
Yeah.
18,000 empty units.
That's the kind of world they want. They want a world of like pure profit. Like I said before, it's like, which is another reason why we also emphasize the sort of a direct action component, because it's about how it's trying to transform street culture. And so when you see like we have this national or international houselessness, you know, concern where, you know, people are, you know, a lot of these people were housed, and it's like all these policies is this YIMBYism that actually causes all this stuff to happen and all this stress, and it's all in service of profit. Like it's not for the people, even though they try to manufacture and pretend that it isn't for, you know. It's really awful.
So direct house or direct action is the way that we make this conversation serious, basically.
Squatting.
No, sounds great. So we've got another caller per pair.
Yeah, that's me.
Hi.
Well, you know, as far as the homeless situation goes, when you have so much money floating around at the top of the scale and so little at the bottom, this is really inevitable. So if you really want to get, you know, the ultimate solution would be to have a maximum income, which might be kind of pie in the sky for a lot of people, but in the meantime, how about a public bank that can float bond measures so we don't have to pay interest to Wall Street
every
time we pass a bond measure?
A public bank could also finance property purchase on the behalf of collectives in the city.
We could all also back it off our hospital rates and things instead of whatever random Fed Reserve thing they try to decide, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm down with all that. That sounds like a great idea.
Well, that's one possible solution. The other would be, I don't think property tax is such a great thing because it hurts poor people. It's beyond their control. You live, say, you know, you live in a working class neighborhood, and all of a sudden the property values go up, your tax goes up.
Yep.
You can't afford to live there, so it you know, the property tax kind of speeds up gentrification.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And one thing they could do for that would be a homestead exemption.
Yeah, something like that.
You get a tax break on, say, the first $100,000 value of your home. And it's only good if you live in your home. It's not good if you're a landlord or whatever. So that would be something to think about.
Okay.
Yeah, there are tons of market fixes is the thing. And that's actually one of the things about the YIMBY narrative that's really telling, is that they talk about these things but never actually do them.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed, like, when we had... the 2001 bill that came through a couple weeks ago, it was very much with that rhetoric about, you know, trickle down housing and you know, we're going to build market rate and it's going to, you know, help. And then there's nothing in the bill that actually requires affordable housing or even accessible housing be built with this, like, subsidized money.
Well, thanks for calling, Per. We're about out of time here. Of course, there are no real solutions under a capitalist system.
That's right. Very true.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
I just wanted to real quick for our folks from Gay Shame. Thanks so much for joining us. Are there any like big takeaways that you think that we should all be working on going forward?
Yeah, I think that, you know, as you said before, you know, squatting and then also being incredibly suspicious of policy because the things that, you know, people mobilize to try to make into policy wind up also, you know, later on down the road being what you're trying to fight against. So we need to find other solutions and definitely just, you know, destroying this dismantling capitalism and everything.
Yeah, we'll be in touch, I'm sure. Cool. Thanks for calling in, yo.
You guys are as rad as we thought you would be. Thanks so much for calling in and being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we'll talk soon.
Yeah, maybe we'll follow up to do a podcast. We can actually do podcasts here at KBOO, from what I understand, too. Go check out all the podcasts KBOO has to offer, by the way.
Yeah.
So I want real where the music's coming up, but so standing room, SROs in Portland, they've been declining radically. Are there any left?
I think that there are maybe one or two. There are not very many. Some of them have been taken over by like Home Forward or Central City Concern are being run as incremental housing, so like temporary housing to get people into permanent housing. But I do think that there are only a couple. Most of them have been turned into boutique hotels in what is now known as the... on Harvey Milk, the Glamour District.
Yeah. Portland also has a really unique racist history of importing labor, too, and kind of sticking them wherever they could make new housing.
Yeah, actually, if we do a podcast with Gay Shame, we should talk about Stark, and we should talk about mm-hmm. the reification of, like, the gay image in Portland as well.
Indeed. All right. Well, thanks so much, Sarah and Jonathan. Once again, third Wednesday with Portland Assembly. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Talk at you next month with you all.
We love
all
talking. Right.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week.
Thank you, Paul.